Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest and You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's primary election day in New Hampshire with several key party nomination races to be decided. NHPR's coverage begins tonight at 8, so please join us for that. This hour, we're going to focus on two natural phenomena that many Granite Staters are noticing this year. First, what is up with all the squirrels? They seem to be everywhere this year, especially as roadkill. We find out why and what that could mean for predator species who benefit from a hefty squirrel population. Later in the hour, an update on New Hampshire's fight against the tree-killing emerald ash borer. But first, the squirrels. Let's get your questions and stories in. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. For this first part of our show today, we have two guests. Michael Steele joins us by phone. He's a professor of biology at Wilkes University in Pennsylvania, co-author of the book North American Tree Squirrels. And Professor Steele, really nice to have you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Also with us in studio, Dave Anderson, Senior Director of Education at the Forest Society. And Dave, welcome back. It's always really nice to see
you. Thanks, Laura. It's great to see you too.
Well, Dave, you first. Why so many, many, many squirrels here in New Hampshire this year?
Well, I like to always say that everything starts in the forest, and certainly in this case it does.
Yeah.
It's all about oak trees and their periodic seed crops. And we had, in short, boom, mast, quote-unquote, years. In 2015, 2016, and 2017, the population has built up, and now it's the inevitable collapse with a non-mast here for red oak. And that's why the squirrels are in motion, because they're dispersing looking for food.
So lots and lots of acorns, lots and lots of food. So squirrels had two litters instead of one.
Yep.
And now there's so many, and now they're going crazy because there's not enough food.
Right. There was probably great reproduction and survival for the last several years, but particularly last February in the winter breeding season for the spring birth, and then the spring breeding season for the summer birth. And now those young of the year, particularly those summer births, juveniles are moving around, looking for food and dispersing from their parental territories.
Well, moving around a lot, we should say. And Professor Steele, what are you seeing in Pennsylvania? Pretty much the same story?
Actually, we're not. It looks like we're going to have a high mast year this year.
Oh, okay.
And I suspect that this phenomenon is restricted to New England, but we're not seeing it in Pennsylvania right now.
So you're expecting a high mast year this year, Professor Steele?
That's correct.
And so that'll mean next year you'll be...
My lab has been monitoring mast for about 17 years, and all indications are that we're going to have a high mast year.
So next year you'll be doing this show with somebody else talking about the squirrels.
Quite possibly, yeah.
So,
although this phenomenon doesn't happen on a regular basis, it takes a unique combination of high mast followed by a complete mast failure. And certainly great survival success of the squirrels in order for this to occur. And it looks like from the literature, this has occurred much more often in the past, perhaps when we had American chestnut as part of the picture.
Oh, I see.
And so that added to the food supply. American chestnut tends to produce on an annual basis with rare failures.
I just want to ask you something that Dave mentioned, which is interesting. So again, as he described, there was this big mast year here in northern New England. Lots of squirrels were born. Now there's a bit of a food shortage going on because there's so many squirrels and because this isn't a mast year for us here. How do, Professor Steele, squirrels typically respond to this food shortage?
Well, typically they only reproduce once a year, and late summer production or reproduction is not nearly as common as they produce in the fall on a in February on a regular basis, and then a second litter is uncommon, and they typically only do it when there's evidence of high food abundance available for the fall, and that's followed by high survival of all the squirrels, high winter survival, and then if the following year there's a mast failure, then that's when we see this. So it takes a combination of different factors for this to occur.
We all have watched squirrels hide their food, Professor Steele. When there is a shortage of food, do they go about that differently?
They store what they can. We are learning. That's my primary area of research, and we're finding that individual squirrels tend to have priority over their own caches, but they exhaust their food supply earlier in the fall when seed crops are lower.
I think I read this on something you wrote, Professor Steele, and correct me if I'm wrong, please, that squirrels have a unique way of assessing whether an acorn is good, right? Like they shake it or something. Can you explain that process to us so when we see these squirrels doing things in our backyards, we might understand a little bit better?
Sure. Well, they go through a whole series of processes in which they are assessing seed quality with respect to whether it can be stored for a long period of time. So they basically assess seeds on white oaks versus red oaks based on perishability, and then they also shake the seed, as you said, to determine if it's infested with insects such as curculio or weevil larvae.
So they shake it and they can tell if it's infested with larvae or not.
Yeah, and so they're highly sensitive to whether the seed is perishable or storable. White oaks are not because they germinate immediately in the fall, so they selectively eat white oaks and they store red oaks.
Well,
and then if either is infested, in the cases where they do store white oaks, they will excise the embryo with their incisors, and that kills the seed. So it's a dead end for the seed, but it still allows them to store the white oak for up to 6 months.
Dave, I got to say, it kind of reminds me of somebody going through the grocery store and like squeezing the peaches to see if they're good or not.
Exactly. I mean, they're just testing to see how long they will have the food supply, and then through the season they also manage the caches, so they know where their caches are, and as they revisit caches, they assess whether it's been damaged by fungus or anything else. And then consistently they eat infested and damaged seeds, partially damaged seeds, and then store the sound seeds.
Okay, so they know that those ones will spoil first, so let's eat those and hide the good stuff for later. Dave Anderson, go ahead.
Well, this is actually a white oak mast here in New Hampshire. So in the forest, there's a ton of white oak acorns, and they have much less tannin in them. And walking out in the woods now, you're seeing branches that are cut with clusters of white oak acorns. There are no red oak acorns, but red oak makes up probably 95% of the oak forest. White oak is isolated in kind of hot, dry, south-facing sites that are really well-drained, places that grow hop, horn, beam in a drier forest. So the majority in the supermarket, if you will, the red oak, are not producing acorns this year. We also don't have a great beech mast crop. The other thing that we've been seeing is squirrels and other animals moving into farmlands looking for apples, looking for corn. This summer, there were bears in my neighbor's chicken coops, in my chicken coop. They were getting beehives and commercial bees. My corn disappeared in a matter of a week when we were not home because the squirrels just cleaned it out.
Oh.
So it's not like there's no food and the squirrels are all starving and on a forced hunger march. They're just moving to other food sources. In the Concord area, shagbark hickory, which has a great nut crop on it, those are preferentially getting hammered by squirrels because there's no red oak acorns. So they're moving out of the woods and they're moving into suburbs and crossing roads and getting hit.
Well, our listeners have definitely been noticing, which is why we're talking about it today. And I want to hear from you if you've got a question about what you have seen from squirrels this year or a comment, or a story to share, we'd love to hear from you. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And both of you, here's an email that came in from Doug in Concord, who says, with the increase in squirrels, other small rodents, and deer, thanks to all the acorn years, will this increase the risk of Lyme disease? Professor Steele, do you know, first of all, he's got another question too, Doug does, but do squirrels carry ticks that carry Lyme disease?
They carry ticks. They do carry the Lyme tick, but they are not a primary vector of the disease. It's this the white-footed mouse, Paramyscus leucopus, that is the primary agent for the disease, and they are a primary host for the tick, and they are highly sensitive. They feed primarily on acorns, and their numbers go sky high following about a year after a high mass crop.
Well, we have talked a lot on the show about the mice and their role in spreading ticks and disease.
Lyme risk increases with the increase in mice.
In mice, but not so much the squirrels, to answer Doug's question?
No.
So Doug has another question.
They tend not to be a primary vector for the disease. I mean, they can acquire, they can carry the bacterium, but it's not nearly as significant as the white-footed mouse.
So Doug has another question that I did want to ask you, Professor Steele, given, again, your many years watching squirrel behavior. Doug says, I unfortunately saw a squirrel get hit on the road here in Concord. It's a strangely violent and unfortunate thing to witness. Both the squirrel and the car were trying to avoid each other. And Doug, I really appreciate the story because, Professor Steele, I've had the same experience where I see a squirrel, I slow down, it looks like he or she is backing off, so I keep driving. And then the squirrel sort of darts in and out, and I'm trying not to hit it, but, you know, darn it, work with me, squirrel. I mean, why do they do that?
That erratic behavior most likely evolved to escape aerial attack by aerial predators. And so when they feel threatened by a car, they go into that mode where they go back and forth, and that actually is very typical, and I get that question all the time, but
yeah,
it's likely an evolved strategy in response to aerial predators such as hawks.
Well, Doug, thank you for the question. It's one I had myself. You can send us an email as well, exchange@nhpr.org. And gentlemen, let's take a call. Charlie is calling from Laconia. Hi, Charlie. You're on the Exchange. Welcome. Go ahead.
Good morning. I witnessed something yesterday that really puzzled me. I've seen in the past clusters of squirrels that look like they all died in a group. There'll be three or four right in the same, within a few feet of each other or closer. Yesterday, I saw a squirrel run out into the road where there were two dead squirrels, and he was jumping around one of them. Like, in my mind, I'm thinking, God, is he trying to revive this guy?
Wow.
And, you know, I laid on the horn, and then he decided to, fortunately, go back into the woods. But I just wondered if they have some sort of social, I don't know, togetherness where that's possible.
Well, Charlie, thank you for the call. And I was driving home from the North Country this weekend, and in the Tilton area, I sort of saw what you saw, Charlie, just a whole bunch of dead squirrels, like all in the same spot. It was pretty gross. Professor Steele, can you help us out with that?
That's a tough one. I don't have an immediate explanation. I have had reports where squirrels will investigate other dead squirrels. As far as an explanation for the adaptive significance of it, it's really hard to explain. Gray squirrels tend to be a little more social than some other squirrels, like fox squirrels, which are also tree squirrels, more common in the Midwest. But they are not what we would classify as a highly social animal. So they tend to operate on their own individually in the forest and maintain their own home range. Social interactions tend to be rare. So it's an interesting observation.
Well, and Professor Steele, I know we got to let you go because you've got to be somewhere by 9:15. But last question. Some people think squirrels are cute. Other people think they're pests. Certainly it's been pretty gross to see all the roadkill this year. What good are squirrels, Professor Steele.
Squirrels are a primary dispersal agent of trees, oak and hickory, but in particular the oaks. They are a keystone species with respect to their impact on dispersing seeds and maintaining forest regeneration.
All right. Professor Steele, it's really nice to have you on the air with us today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's Professor Michael Steele. He's a professor of biology at Wilkes University in Pennsylvania, co-author of the book North American Tree Squirrels. Dave Anderson, as a tree guy, you probably really appreciated the professor's answer there. What good are squirrels?
I like the focus on the forest and the relationship between forests and their seed dispersers, because we tend to think in linear kind of cause and effect ways, and everything is cyclical and connected within an ecosystem. If you pull one string, you'll find it's attached to everything else in the universe, to paraphrase Muir. So there was a lot of good questions in there. There are in those, both of the questions, there are landscape features that funnel squirrels to certain areas. And people have noticed there's many more squirrels dead along entrance and exit ramps to highways than along the highway itself, because that exit ramp is cutting through kind of a forested matrix. And the squirrels are moving, you know, within the forest, and they just happen to encounter a ramp. And so there's higher rates of roadkill, you know, on the entrance and exit ramps. Also in parts of town where it's the Miracle Mile, or there's chain link fence and asphalt parking lots and curbing and a lot of built infrastructure, there's going to be naturally fewer squirrels. So it's variable along the roads to see those roadkill rates. But people are paying attention.
Well, and as I said, I drove back from the North Country this weekend, didn't see any dead squirrels in the North Country, saw a few as I was, you know, in the White Mountains and the Northern Lakes region. But by the time I hit sort of the Central Lakes region, you know, Meredith, by the time I got to Tilton, it was crazy. So why the regional variability,
Dave?
Well,
they've been moving, actually. Gray squirrels have been expanding population northward, and they only recently opened up the northern part of the state to squirrel hunting. And the squirrel hunting season runs from September 1st through January 31st. Traditionally, the North Country and the northern part of the state is a conifer forest, and that's the realm of the red squirrel.
Oh, I see.
Which is more solitary and less gregarious than gray squirrels. They overlap through most of New Hampshire, and people are now seeing red squirrels moving as well as gray squirrels here around Concord. So I was hearing stories of red squirrels interacting with the gray squirrels that are on migration. So when you're up in the North Country, you wouldn't expect to have as high a population density of gray squirrels. They're adapted to the southern central temperate hardwood forest, the oak, hickory, beech forest that we
have.
That's
where the food is that they like.
Yes.
Okay, that's interesting. And Michael sent us an email. He says, what is the food source near the 89 South, 93 South merger? It seems to be a particularly strong draw for squirrels. Michael, thank you for the question. This kind of gets to what you just said, Dave, right? Like, there's certain areas where they seem to flow out of the forest and onto the highway.
Right, and so it might be landscape or neighborhoods or built infrastructure that's funneling them to a spot. It also could be a food source. There's, you know, in the Concord area, shagbark hickory and beaked hazelnut, to a much lesser extent, New Hampshire butternut and black walnut. But that by far the majority most important species is red oak mast or acorns, and they are just not available this year. And fortunately, the white oak acorns are. But I would say it's shagbark hickory that I've seen other people have, you know, you can literally hear the nut husks raining down out of the forest. It's a great time of year to be a crow or a raven or a turkey vulture. Who are scavenging roadside. So there's a lot of that. I mean, so we tend to focus on, oh my God, all the dead squirrels, but think about how happy times it is to be a scavenger.
Well, and in a minute, I want to ask you a little bit more
sure.
about that, because that's really interesting. Also got a note from someone who asks about swimming squirrels, which we will definitely talk about. We'll keep taking your questions and comments. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. What have you noticed about all the squirrels in central and southern New Hampshire this year? We'll take your comments at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. All that's coming up, so stay with us.
Sometimes less is more. NHPR sustaining members make it possible to spend less time fundraising and more time bringing you programs like All Things Considered, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and The Exchange. When you become a sustaining member today, you can help shorten our next on-air fund drive. For every 100 listeners who become sustaining members, we'll deduct one full day from the drive. It's that simple. Become a sustainer today for as little as $10 a month at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, a question many of our listeners have been asking: why so much squirrel roadkill this year? And what seems like some pretty unusual squirrel behavior. Send us your stories, photos, and questions to exchange at nhpr.org, or post on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Dave Anderson is helping us out, Senior Director of Education at the Forest Society. And Dave, Cara sent us a note. She says, I saw two squirrels swimming across Turi Pond. I didn't know they could swim. Cara, thank you so much. Dave, I was kayaking in the Merrimack River on Labor Day, saw something, and I thought, oh, cool, it's an otter. Mm-hmm. So I paddled over real quickly, and I thought, oh, it's a squirrel. But hang on, I didn't know squirrels could swim. So, yeah, a lot of people have been talking about
right.
this.
Right, and so the literature always says they're strong swimmers and they can swim as much as 2 miles and survive.
And this guy I saw was a very strong swimmer. He was going mm-hmm. fast.
And we heard about swimming squirrels about mid-August, and people were kind of incredulous. And we put right. up a Facebook post on the Forest Society's Facebook page, and we got dozens and dozens and dozens of comments and photos and Me Too from all around the state,
wow.
all the lakes in southern New Hampshire. Funny anecdotal things. Somebody said, yeah, but they wait until dart out in front of a motorboat, and then they jive, you know, juke and jive each way. but they're actually climbing on boats and being transported to the other side by, you know, kindly fishermen and kayakers. And
why are they doing that?
Well, they're trying to get to a food source, so they're moving. And so down at our Concord Conservation Center headquarters, they were sort of moving en masse from the one bank to the other, and then a few swimming kind of against the grain the other way. So it's not like a generalized movement of the entire population from the east bank to the west bank or from the north to the south. But they're moving in response to availability of food or the perceived need to disperse, because they're needing to disperse from their parental territories because the population's so high.
So in general, in a more normal year, you don't see this, Dave?
Yeah, they wouldn't risk that. In fact, it suggests that occasionally like a largemouth bass can take a squirrel. So for them, jumping into the water isn't something they would prefer to do. We have a naturalist who hikes on the floodplain every morning, and she wrote about watching them take preparation. And she said two guys in a motorboat said they were watching one swim toward them, and it crawled up one side of the boat and skidded across and hopped out the other side.
Oh, my goodness.
She's been watching their pre-river swim preparations and had the opportunity to watch many different squirrels get ready. They do the same sort of thing. They crawl along a snag, and they stare at the water for a long time, because the decision to swim is a pretty weighty decision for a squirrel. And it's kind of unusual to see a squirrel sitting in one place all that time.
Right. She pretty skittish. They jump around a lot.
She was watching several oak trees by the highway bridge where 93 goes across. And she said there were five squirrels at the same time at the very ends of different limbs just staring at the water. They do a lot of grooming. They pay a lot of attention to their tails and rubbing their tails on their faces. And they crawl along the limb, and they kind of drag their bodies flat against the branch, and then they sit up and groom again. They pay a lot of attention to their groin area, because there's kind of a gland, an oil gland, and they're using that to sort of prepare their fur and their face, and they swim with their head elevated and their rump elevated and their tail up above the water.
Yes, I noticed that. It was almost like a flotation device, the tail right there on top of
exactly.
the water. It looked kind of handy.
Well,
actually,
they're trying to kind of keep it out of the water because of the weight of the tail would kind
sure.
of drag them down. So they're sizing it up. She actually saw one cannonball into the water, and she realized later that it wasn't jumping. It just lost its balance while it was up on a limb, and it was preening and grooming itself in preparation for the swim across the Merrimack River. And they also seem to look for a particular spot. Like they pick out, they come down to the bank, they don't jump out of the tree, and they run back and forth and they pick a spot. And then she saw them simultaneously pushing off, and she said it looked like a swim team meet. There were five or six squirrels, you know, swimming in tandem together, maybe safety in numbers.
Well, so it seems like they, at least biologically, have some sort of an oil that mm-hmm. protects them a little bit, so nature has prepared them for this possibility that they might have to swim, even
sure.
if they don't like to.
Well, they have to have waterproofing anyway, even living in the forest in New Hampshire for rainy seasons.
Sure.
So, I mean, they can't just get hypothermic in their trees when things get wet for a week at a time.
Well, thank you for reading that description of
sure.
them getting ready to swim. That's really interesting. And back to our listeners, again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And email is exchange@nhpr.org. Let's go to Kim in Concord, Dave. Hi, Kim. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi there. Good morning.
Good morning.
I just wanted to share kind of an anecdotal observation that I have made throughout my adult life.
Sure.
I've done a lot of driving, and I have found that when a squirrel is doing that thing where they're like, which way do I go? And if you just honk your horn and not lay on your horn, but go beep, 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 they will run back to the side of the road. They will run right back. And it works for deer. It works for pretty much all animals. And I really wanted to share that. And it works so well that my six-year-old, he'll do it with his own mouth if he sees this squirrel. He's like, honk, 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 honk. Like, yeah. And he'll be like, okay, good. He ran, you know.
So safe. Don't lay on the horn, Kim. Do a succession of quick beeps.
Right, yeah. And I know it's not scientific or whatever, but it's just what I have observed.
Well, Kim, thank you for sharing. It's great to hear from you. And Dave, what do you think?
Well, I like what Mike Steele talked about, is how this is an innate behavior to dodge aerial predators. And now, speaking of dodge, they have to dodge Ford Falcons instead of real Falcons.
Right.
Or, you know, Eagle Talon or something. We name our cars after raptors.
So do you lay on the horn when you see a squirrel, Dave?
I slow way down. I tend to lay on the brake and try to figure out which way it's going to go.
But yeah, Sometimes that's not safe, though.
I'll try that right on the interstate. And you know, people have said, you know, people are really disturbed because they're seeing squirrels get hit on a regular basis. I think we're beginning to see it tail off a little bit. The rates of new roadkill seem to have been reduced in the last couple of days. That might just be because we're running out of squirrels. I mean, a lot of squirrels have to die in order to perpetuate the squirrel population as they move.
All right, let's take another call. Kim, thank you so much for that one. Jessica's calling in from Barrington. Hi, Jessica, you're on the exchange. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Sure.
So my comment is that this is a really great opportunity for us to discuss ways that we could be building with animal crossings in mind, especially as we continue to build infrastructure and we're taking into account climatic change in our roadways and elevations. Does Dave or anybody else have any ideas on ways that citizens could get involved in advocating for that, or successful animal crossings that we've seen working in other parts of the country? Because I know that as soon as we stop seeing the squirrels, they're kind of going to be out of sight, out of mind. But I think that this is something that's important, not just for the squirrels, but for all of the other animals in our state.
So
and I'll take the answer off the air.
Jessica, thank you so much. Yeah.
In other parts of the country, they've done some work where there's mass migrations of things like elk, bison. In New Hampshire, they've done some work with amphibian crossings for vernal pools in the springtime. They've actually had road closures in the Keene area on the big night, the first rain. The squirrel phenomenon is a really kind of an unusual and rare and not a typical thing. But certainly as our cities and towns grow, there are pinch points. You could look at a Google Earth map and look at forested blocks of habitat and where those lie adjacent to busy roads. Those are going to be crossing areas. We've all seen the signs that say the moose crossing. And then, of course, the joke is the out-of-state tourist says, like, how did the moose know to cross there? it's something to think about. Certainly protecting blocks of forest land to provide habitat is one thing, but then the connections and the travel corridors between areas of core habitat is really important to plan for across the greater landscape. And the highway departments in other parts of the country have looked at doing wildlife underpasses to allow mass migrations in areas where that's a regular phenomenon, not an unusual one like here in New Hampshire.
Well, I was in Western Canada 2 years ago in the Rocky Mountains out in, I think the province was Alberta. I think we were in a couple different provinces, but I think it was Alberta, Dave, that people go there because it's beautiful, because they want to hike, and they do not want to see dead, beautiful animals,
right,
bears or whatever, on the road. So they've built this, they have fences in the woods, wire fences, and then they have this series of underpasses and overpasses,
right, channeling,
for animals.
Channeling,
yeah,
those animals to a crossing.
They got a whole display on how it works and stuff, and you can pull over and find out how it works.
I had a colleague who was in Yellowstone with his family this summer, and he was telling me about where there was a large roadkill, and they actually closed the road down at dusk, and they allow the bears and other scavengers to come in and feed on it because that's a food source. So instead of cleaning it up with a shovel and carting it away, I mean, I've been looking at the crows and the ravens and things that are actually having a field day. Another thing is we're not connecting it, but owls. A lot of people have been talking about owls this summer, and they've been hearing the owls every night. We have a sky-high owl population right now for the very same reason. Last winter on the snowpack, there were white-footed mouse tracks everywhere. I've never seen so many mouse tracks as they were scurrying around. So their populations were really high. And so we had really good survival of our winter-born or late winter-born barred owls. And this summer, there have been juvenile owls vocalizing everywhere. And actually, they made me aware of a squirrel vocalization that's called a death squeal. And the other night, there were owls vocalizing, and they were hunting a pair of juveniles with an adult. And then we heard a squirrel screeching. I thought it was a rabbit. And we went to investigate, and the owls had a squirrel. So they're...
Wow, like wild kingdom at your house.
Well, everywhere. I mean, there's just so much protein from mice, chipmunks, red squirrels, gray squirrels, a sky-high rodent population. This is naturally going to ripple up through the food chain. So raptors, as well as other predators, foxes, coyotes, bobcats, times are really fat and happy. So move fast forward to 18 months and look at what's going to happen when these populations crash. And then the food stress is going to be transmitted up the food chain.
To the bobcats and the foxes.
Yeah,
so
you have to look at the big cycle. You know, you're looking at cycles of a year, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, and these things are recurring across the landscape. The mass squirrel migration is not a really typical thing. As Michael Steele said, this is something that has to have just the right conditions to trigger, you know, this sort of mass movement. And I've noticed that the majority of the ones that are getting hit are juveniles. They're the young of the year.
The ones who are sort of leaving the nest and trying to figure it out and
Right.
not doing a very good job. You know, you talked about the predators and how now there's all this squirrel protein available for not just raptors, but also higher up the food chain, bobcats and foxes and so forth. So are we going to start seeing those animals as roadkill, Dave, as they sort of go out on the road to grab those squirrel carcasses, or are they sort of smarter about it?
Yeah, they're not scavengers, so they're going to be hunting them in the woods, and they're probably feasting right now. Someplace right now, there is a sated coyote burping underneath a tree someplace, or an owl. The ones that are in the road are basically our crows and ravens and turkey vultures that will scavenge dead roadkill. Even a bald eagle is a pretty good scavenger, and I imagine that they're also picking off squirrels that are swimming across rivers. So squirrels are taking risks, and the predators are, whether they're scavengers or whether they're predators, are benefiting from that.
Okay, so the predator birds are pretty good at swooping down, grabbing some roadkill,
and it all starts with the trees. I mean, that's the thing, is it's good for people. I'm really happy that people are actually noticing this and connecting it, and then also learning about things like the cycle of mass crop years, hard mass for seeds, and then soft mass for things like corn, berries, and apples.
Well, speaking of the trees, John in Durham writes, "My yard has a lot of shagbark hickories," which you mentioned earlier, Dave, "and they've produced more nuts this year than I've ever seen. Of course, my yard is now infested," John says, "with gray squirrels. They climb the trees and sit up there chewing the husks off the nuts, so the pieces of husks sound like rain pouring down from the trees." Wow, John. He says, "The squirrels also clip the nuts off the branches, and the nuts come banging down on my roof and my deck." John, thank you for that story. That's great. Mike emailed us some photos of squirrels eating from his suet feeder, which we'll post on our website. And Mike says, "Any advice to listeners about if they can or should remove roadkill?" He says, "Call your local DPW, leave them for crows or other birds of prey." Mike's asking, what do you think, Dave?
I would say move it off the roadway so that the animal that's going to scavenge that isn't going to get hit by a passing car.
But if you can, safely,
obviously. Yeah, leave it out there in the landscape for a scavenger to find as it breaks down. It's a food source for a while.
All right. Denise on Twitter says, "The squirrels climb up on our sunflowers and bend them over until they break.
Yeah.
Then they have easy access to the seeds. 15 or more of the sunflowers on the ground right now." Sorry about that, Denise. Sunflowers are one of my favorite flowers.
We lost our sunflowers. We lost all of our corn. There's not a great wild apple crop year. And we sort of knew this was coming. We saw the bears moving out of the forest, you know, and by midsummer they were in the chicken coops and in the beehives. And And certainly the squirrels have been sort of rampaging in the farmlands because there's just not a lot to eat. And also disproportionate pressure on things like a good shagbark hickory forest and a good mass crop for shagbark hickory. They're just switching food sources and moving to the hickory nuts because the red oak acorns are not available.
All right. Well, great questions from our listeners. Let's go back to the phones, Dave. Patty's in Portsmouth. Hi, Patty. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Actually, I live in the south end of Dover on the Bellamy River, and I saw a black squirrel, and I have never seen a black squirrel. So is this something that's changing? Is that...
And you're pretty sure it was
around?
A black squirrel, Patty, not just a sort of very dark gray squirrel?
No, it was black.
Yeah, there's actually... Okay. We did a little something wild on that very same topic. There is a melanistic or a black gene that expresses itself in squirrels, just like there are leucocystic or rather an albino squirrel is possible. So that's just the rare... anomaly in the population. It's not like a phenomenon that's, you know, changing in response. What is changing is squirrels moving, you know, extending their range northward. Something to
gray
think
squirrels.
About. Gray squirrels. But think about the fact that in New Hampshire, gray squirrels would give way to red squirrels in the White Mountains. The same true is true for other species. Deer give way to moose about the White Mountains. Bobcats give way to Canada lynx about the White Mountains. So there's boreal species that are more adapted to a coniferous forest, a northern habitat that occur from the central part of New Hampshire and the White Mountains farther north all the way up to the limit of tree growth at Hudson's Bay. And that overlap takes place right in New Hampshire.
All right. Thank you for that call, Patty. And let's take another one in Portsmouth. This is Lynn. Hi, Lynn. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. This
sure.
is very interesting. We live in Portsmouth in a neighborhood near downtown. My neighbors and I have noticed that the squirrels have been frantic this year. Two things. They come right, like if you're sitting on the patio, they'll come right up to you, which is very unusual. And they've chewed a hole in my roof near the chimney, and we're having to cut back trees to keep them off the roof.
Oh, boy. And
so
that's, yeah.
I would think about feeding them, but I think I can't if they're chewing up my house.
Yeah, that seems pretty reasonable, Lynn, and that could be an expensive fix for you. What do you think, Dave?
People with bird seed have much higher rates of damage from mice, chipmunks, red squirrels, and gray squirrels moving into their house. So it's kind of a nice thing to feed birds in the winter, but to back off. But people who feed year-round are basically sustaining a little regional population of dependent rodents. And, you know, provide the food, they'll stay there. People in cities feed them peanuts. People in the country, I don't know people in the country feeding, you know, acorns or certainly cracked corn. But you're gonna have dependent squirrels if you feed them.
Okay, and that answers another question that Tom in Exeter had about bird seed, wondering if squirrels ate bird seed, and it sounds like yes, they do. So
yes.
Please put the bird feeder away once winter's over. Let's get one more call in if we could. Arlene is in Peterborough. Hi, Arlene. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, I live in the Monadnock region, and we have peach trees in our front yard. And this, for the first year, we've noticed a lot of squirrels coming into our front yard, grabbing the peaches and running into the backyard. And we were wondering, are they going after the pit on the inside, or are they eating the meat?
Oh, they're eating the fruit. Yeah, we lost all our peaches, too. Yeah, farmers are really getting hammered by squirrels, and because they're moving out of the forest.
Wow. Arlene, sorry about that. I mean,
the only thing I haven't seen them eating yet is zucchini and summer squash and tomatoes, but I have to look closer. But yeah, our garden got hammered, and a lot of people are reporting the same thing just because they're hungry and they're dispersing.
All right. Well, Arlene, thank you for the call. You can give us a call or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Let's call from Portsmouth today, Dave. So Carolyn's in Portsmouth as well. Hi, Carolyn. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have another swimming episode. About a week ago, my husband and I were going down the Piscataqua River to go fishing, and we saw what we thought was an otter as well.
And yeah.
He went back and saw that it was a squirrel. He started turning. He was halfway across the river. He started turning to go back toward the shore. So we left him, and he headed back. And then we saw a second one a few minutes later. Now, the Piscataqua there is very wide. It's brackish. It's very strong current. And, you know, my husband said, you didn't have a very good chance of making it to the other side, probably. And in all our years of fishing, we had never seen anything like that.
Yeah, well, and me too. Carol, I got to wrap you up. I do apologize. but I had the same feeling all my years, you know, recreating on the Merrimack River. I had never seen anything like that. So
saltwater squirrel.
Yeah, there you go. Well, Dave, stick around.
Sure.
And listeners, stick around as well, because coming up, we're going to turn to another tree-related subject. We are going to get an update on the state's fight against the emerald ash borer, which unfortunately is taking a toll on our ash trees. So we'll hear about that coming up. By the way, as we talk about squirrels, if you have questions about other animals or plants around the Granite State, send them in to Ask Sam at NHPR's Outside In podcast. Go to our website. There's a big Ask Sam box on the homepage, so check it out. And we'll be right back talking about the emerald ash borer in just a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, a fall election forecast after today's primary voting. So that's Wednesday morning on The Exchange. Right now, we're going to look at how the state is battling the spread of the emerald ash borer, which has been very successful in killing our ash trees. Let's get your questions in. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or post it on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, the email, exchange@nhpr.org. Still with me in studio, Dave Anderson, Senior Director of Education at the Forest Society. And with us now on the phone is Brad Simpkins, Director of New Hampshire's Division of Forest and Lands. He's also the state's forester. And Brad, welcome back. Good to have you.
Thanks, Laura. Appreciate being on.
Well, before we talk about the state's efforts to contain or eradicate this pest, which I know we're a long, long way away from that, just remind us, Brad, how bad has this become? How much have these bugs killed off our ash trees?
So, actually, New Hampshire has a pretty good story to tell in that regard. We first found EAB in the state, in the Concord area, in 2013. But due to quick actions, primarily by three main organizations, Department of Agriculture, Markets and Food, Forests and Lands, and UNH Cooperative Extension, you know, we jumped on it quick, and there were quarantines in place. We did a lot of education, and really the spread in the state has been more natural spread. And under its own spread, it doesn't go that quick. It's really human-induced movement that makes it spread quick. So while we have been seeing it spread out from the Concord area up to the Lakes region, there's still a large chunk of our ash resource in the state that's unimpacted.
So a quarantine, just remind us what that means.
So really what the quarantine is meant for is to keep things out. So as soon as we find a pest in an area, we quarantine that county. And that's really particularly using federal regulations. That's the smallest area we can quarantine effectively. So as soon as we find something in a county, we quarantine that to try to prevent anything from leaving that county and affecting the neighboring counties.
How do you do that? How do you do that quarantine, though?
Well, we do it through several different things. One is through education. That's the primary way. We need to let people know that our moving wood, so loggers and nursery folks and people who are moving firewood and those types of things, we need to let them know that they need to keep certain wood, such as ash in this instance, within the county and not move it out, particularly during the summer months when the beetle is active and can fly. We also do enforcement. Our forest rangers will do roadside firewood checks to educate people and let them know that they can't bring firewood into non-infested areas. We go out and we work with all the different various mills and things like that to let them know what the rules and regulations are so that they don't accidentally spread the bug.
And,
so,
with campgrounds too, there's sort of the whole buy it where you burn it campaign for camping areas. So, you know, even camping and family are getting the message that they shouldn't be bringing firewood from home to the places that they're going to recreate on the weekend.
So for professionals, just reminding, you know, professional loggers and so forth, watch out for where this bug is spreading. And for regular folks, hey, as you said, Dave Anderson, buy it where you
burn it.
Burn it where you buy it. What have you noticed in terms of ash trees, Dave?
Well, it's spreading. I learned from Kyle Lombard in Brad's office yesterday that it doesn't it's not been found in Coos County, Sullivan County, or Cheshire County. So okay, three of New Hampshire's 10 counties. And also, I'm learning from Brad and his staff about the rules that, you know, regulate this so we can communicate that with forest landowners, education being the first line of defense. I've seen dead ash in Concord, which is ground zero, especially along the Merrimack River, where there tends to be more ash trees. It's a species that grows in sort of moist, wet, riverine areas. It's not in the hot, dry uplands. It's not in the mountains. So it's a species of tree that exists in a much higher density in southern and central New Hampshire from the Lakes region south. It's not going to be found in the upper elevations of the White Mountains, and it would be in swamps and river areas in the northern part of the state. So again, the distribution of ash trees is less. Kyle told me that in Grafton County, where they just found emerald ash borer, there are 30 million ash trees, but only 5 trees that have been found with EAB. So it's not like the entire Grafton County is infested. It's basically, you know, less than 1/100 of 1% of the trees in that county. But since it's found in that county, that's how the quarantine lights up. Like, okay, now we have EAB in Grafton County, but it's in a very small, small contained area.
Interesting. So Brad, when those few trees in Grafton County, for example, as Dave said, are found to be infected with emerald ash borer, what do you do with those particular trees? Do you burn them down? Do you douse them with, you know, emerald ash borer-killing pesticides? I mean, what do you do?
Well, it really, we work with the landowner. It's really, you know, it depends where they are, if it's a yard tree versus out in the middle of the woods. We know, you know, this is natural. Where it was found in Grafton County is just over the border in Bridgewater from a pre-quarantine county. So again, it's not like it was found deep in Grafton County. So the vast ash resource in Grafton County is unimpacted. So we'll try to limit that spread. And that's an important point. Even though the entire county goes into the quarantine and under federal regulations, wood could move anywhere within that county, we're really trying to work with folks and use best management practices about limiting the spread of wood. We still don't want to unnaturally spread this any quicker than it would on its own.
What about that particular tree, though, Brad? I mean, if there's an infected tree, wherever it might be, you know, what do you do with that particular tree?
Well, you can certainly cut that tree down, destroy it, you know, get the bark off. They live just under the bark. So if you can debark it and just that first surface layer, destroy that, you're usually pretty good. Or you can chip it. If you want to burn it, that'll take care of it quickly. But what we found is when you actually have found a tree that is infested, there's typically some other trees around there that have very little sign yet that are already infested. So taking out, say, these, you know, couple trees is not going to get rid of EAB in Grafton County. It's still going to be in that area. So it's more of a long-term management over a larger landscape versus dealing with specific trees.
I want to remind our listeners that you can join us. The number here in the Exchange, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. Or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. For the next few minutes, we're hearing about the state's latest efforts to combat something known as the emerald ash borer, which is a threat, as we're hearing, to our ash trees here in the state. And again, we'd love to get your questions and observations. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Also, by the way, if you have questions about other animals or plants or trees here in the Granite State, send them in to the Outside In team here at NHPR. They want to hear from you. Check out Ask Sam. Go to nhpr.org. There's a big Ask Sam box on the homepage. Or you can leave a message at 1-844-GO-OTTER. That's 844-GO-OTTER. So what about biological controls? I want to hear from both of you, but you first, Brad, meaning, you know, other bugs or creatures that seem programmed to kill emerald ash borers. How much is the state using those so far?
Yeah, so we really think of emerald ash borer control. And we've been working on biocontrol. There's now 3 different species of very small insect. They're actually about the size of a black fly, that are available for us to release. We've been releasing 2 of them for about 5 years now. We're now going to be releasing this 3rd one. And basically, they use EAB as a food source, the different stages of development, and they just feed on EAB. And we're actually seeing, it takes decades to establish biocontrol, but we're actually seeing success already where we've released these little bugs and we're seeing them establish populations, and we've actually picked them up 5 miles from the release point. So that shows us that they are getting established, they are feeding on the emerald ash borer. You know, we take samples throughout the year to look at them to see how effective they are. And so, you know, the ash that's growing in our forest right now, particularly the mature ash, you know, this is going to continue to spread across the state, march across the state. But as it's doing that, we're hoping these biocontrol parasitic wasps are also building up that population with the hope that the next generation of ash, there will always be a bee, but it'll be at a low enough population that the ash will eventually start to come back and survive. So we'll still have ash as a component of our forest. That's the hope.
Well, Brad, thank you for ending on a hopeful note there. And we really appreciate you being with us today. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you.
That's Brad Simpkins, Director of New Hampshire's Division of Forests and Lands. Couple last questions for you, Dave Anderson. Biological controls, as Brad told us, are sometimes worrisome for people. They worry that they might get out of control, they might cause other problems. What are your thoughts or observations
these are
there?
Through the federal APHIS program at the federal level. And so Brad's staff at the Division of Forests and Lands, which is part of the Department of Natural and Cultural Resources, has been working with the feds on this. And so all of this is vetted through forest labs and other parts of the country before they're just dispersed in New Hampshire. As Brad said, they're hoping that the biocontrol, these wasps that parasitize the larvae of the emerald ash borer beetle, will naturalize and spread. And even if most of the big ash are taken out across the region, the emerald, the ash will regrow, and there'll be a younger forest in the future of, you know, 10, 20, 15-year-old ash, and both the biocontrols and the emerald ash borer beetles will be in the landscape, and they'll reach some kind of future stasis. They point to the gypsy moth as an example of where there was a control, a fungus that was introduced in the 1920s, and it took, you know, 60 years to kick in. And by the 1980s infestation, every time there's a gypsy moth buildup and outbreak, the fungus or the kicks in and knocks out the gypsy moth caterpillars.
So it does work. It just takes
time. It does work. It takes time in the landscape to naturalize.
We got an email, Dave, from Katie, who says, I live on a 50-acre farm with a ton of ash trees, and I suspect that one or more may be infected because they are just dropping huge limbs for no reason. What do your guests recommend that homeowners do if they think they have infected trees? Wow, Katie, sorry to hear about that.
Yeah, I'm not a forester. I work more as a naturalist, but I also have a 50-acre farm, and I also have ash in the places you'd expect it along stone walls and little brooks and seeps. I haven't seen any decline in the deep forest, but along the walls, there's another phenomenon called ash yellows that's affecting the health of ash trees. Some people have talked about pre-salvaging. I look around the forest at the ash trees that I have that are healthy, and I've decided to not cut them, to admire them while they're there and to kind of watch and see as the progression takes place. You know, woodpeckers have to make a living too, and actually it's the woodpeckers that are working on the bark with the beetles underneath that is usually your first clue that there's emerald ash borer. They call that blonding, where there's, you know, chipping away at the bark because there's larvae active underneath. I have not seen that where I live in the Kearsarge region, but I've certainly seen that around Concord.
All right, Katie, thank you. Maybe she wants to give the State Division of Forest and Lands
That'd be a good
call.
Idea.
Yeah, all right. Thank you for that email, Katie. Ken is calling in from Meredith. Hi, Ken, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, good morning.
Morning. Go ahead, Ken.
I guess a question that I had for professionals, it seems to be that I noticed that there's an uptick in ash firewood that's being advertised for sale. And I just wanted to see what professionals would say to, you know, professionals who harvest wood with regard to, should there be a limitation to the amount, or are people worried and cutting these ash trees down for no reason because of the emerald ash borer? And what can, you know, what can homeowners or citizens do in the meantime, other than, you know, not transporting wood from other states.
That's interesting, Ken. Thank you for that. So kind of like when a certain animal species is threatened, Dave, they sometimes pull back the hunting permits that are given out. That seems to be where Ken is going with this. If ash is in trouble, why cut it down?
Yeah, but it's going to die anyway. And so there seems to be an acknowledgement that we're going to lose our mature ash across the state as we go through this kind of bottleneck as these biocontrols naturalize. And as you know, we reach a future stasis, ash will, like most hardwoods, stump sprout. So when you're cutting a tree, that stump can still sprout. And there's plenty of ash seeds in the landscape. Actually, last year was a tremendous ash seed crop. Some people thought in response to other stresses, the ash threw a giant a seed year. So there will be ash trees. It'll be a younger ash forest. It does make sense for some landowners to cut the ash trees that they have, recognizing that they're going to die, and to capitalize on their value for firewood.
Interesting. And younger ash trees, it seems, will be healthier because there'll be this cycle of the emerald ash borer dying out?
The emerald ash borer is not going to feed on the young sapling.
It doesn't like them.
Right, they're too small, and they won't support the kind of bark-boring beetles that the emerald ash borer, where it lays its eggs. So it'll reduce the opportunities for the emerald ash borer adult beetles to lay eggs.
So it sounds like, from what I'm hearing from you and from what we heard earlier from Brad Simpkins, this is not a eulogy for ash trees.
No. In fact, Kyle Lombard at Division of Forest Lands told me he's 100% certain that we will still have ash in the landscape 100 years from now.
How important are ash trees for our overall New Hampshire sort of forest ecology?
I think they're a small percentage of the overall forest. They're something like 3-4% of the entire New Hampshire hardwood forest, and tremendously important. It's a great species for furniture and flooring and for millwork. They used formerly ash for tool handles, True Temper up in Vermont. You know, if you go to the hardware store and you're looking for an axe handle or a splitting maul handle or a shovel handle, often made out of ash. Baseball bats, famously. It's a beautiful tree, and it's a food. The seeds are a food source for wildlife. It's sad to think that we're going to lose the mature ash, but we're going to have to go through a period of time where there's some new balance struck. So the idea that people would cut down all the ash trees and we would never see it again is not generally what the foresters that I've talked to think is going to happen.
All right. Well, Dave, thank you so much. It's always good to see you.
Thank you, Laura.
And we really appreciate your insights into both the ash trees and those crazy squirrel phenomena that we talked about earlier.
Happy that people are thinking about our forests in New Hampshire.
All right. That's Dave Anderson, Senior Director at the Forest Society. I also do want to acknowledge that it is 9/11, a sober day in America. And here in New Hampshire, as 10 Granite Staters were aboard those planes involved in the terrorist attack 17 years ago. So there'll be remembrances around the state today. Just wanted to acknowledge that to the audience. Also, be sure to join us tonight at 8 for our live coverage of state primary elections on NHPR, on nhpr.org, and on Facebook Live. And then we'll be back in the morning, of course, with a post-primary preview of the November elections. Thanks for listening, everybody. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.